Hi, this is Brian Hurley. I'd like to share a presentation on lean culture that was given by Maria Grzanka and Ernest Meyer from our Lean Portland team. We were asked to present at the State of Oregon's Department of Human Services annual Lean Academy conference held on August 14th in 2018. It's set up by their Office of Continuous Improvement. The presentation is based on material from the Edgar Schein Onion Model and Maria and Ernest's personal experiences. If you'd like to see the slides and the video, check out the links in the notes or go to leanportland.com, all spelled out. Hope you enjoy.
Good morning, everyone. I think it's wonderful to see you all here and that you have this Lean Academy program, and there's been several cohorts that have gone through it, and you're coming back now to essentially learn from each other and all of your experiences that you've had out in the field. As Lance mentioned, Ernest and I are from Lean Portland, and our mission is to help people make work better. And we're actually a benefit company, but what we really do is free consulting for nonprofits. So we take groups of volunteers to nonprofits, mostly within the Portland area, and there's the people that are members of our group have different varying degrees of background. Some of them have been lean practitioners professionally for quite some time and maybe just looking for networking opportunities. Some people are brand new to lean and they want to meet people that have been doing that for longer. So we take a mixed group of people into different places like the Rebuilding Center, Free Geek, Oregon Entrepreneurs Network. I'm doing a project later this week with DePave. They take out concrete from playgrounds and replace it with natural materials. So we're going to help them 5S add some organization to their storage unit. So Lean Portland was founded by Matt Horvat, the guy in the center. And this is really our kind of leadership team. We're the people that have been showing up consistently for the last couple of years and try to put some structure around our volunteer program. Several of us have had full-time lean or continuous improvement jobs and do this as our volunteer efforts, and others are full-time consultants. We do have a free workshop coming up, and this is part of the programming we do is we host a monthly happy hour in Portland every first Tuesday, and then Kel and Brian also do some free workshops at a co-working space in Portland. So the next one's coming up at the end of the month. It's August 31st. At Hatch in Northeast Portland. But today we're here to talk about culture. So just a quick little fun exercise. Everybody cross your arms. Now cross them the other way. Feels weird, right? I mean, there's a way that we do things that comes naturally to us, and I don't know that one way of crossing your arms is better than the other way, but you know, that's just to show that we do have some ingrained habits that, you know, are personal habits, but they also show up in the workplace too. In talking about culture, there's a lot of different models out there. Let me start with that. And lean culture is really one of the underlying principles of the whole lean body of work. It's also one of the most difficult to talk about and learn and work with. So we try to use models like this to understand a little bit more and unpack how culture works. So this guy, Edgar Schein, came up with this onion model of culture. And the metaphor here is like it's peeling the layers of the onion. So the outer layers of the onion are what he's calling artifacts. The next layer in are values. And then buried in the core is assumptions. Another metaphor that's often used in talking about culture is an iceberg. So the iceberg. You know, of course, there's the piece that we see out above the surface of the water, but below the surface, there's a lot of other stuff going on that we don't necessarily see. And if we're navigating a ship around this thing, we kind of want to know what's going on down there. So Ernest and I are going to take each of these layers at a time, and I think we have some experiential stories to go along with that, in addition to some tools that we'll get to later on in working with culture. So on the artifact side, this is all of the stuff that we do. It's not limited to just things, like the charts and graphs on the walls and the processes and procedures, but it's also the way that we speak to each other. So dialogue is really an artifact, as well as our behaviors. So the way that I've explained this to people is, if I were to video you at any moment in time, everything that I can document as an observable thing or event happening on that, that's all artifacts. Which is usually where we're pretty comfortable in our work life and work situations. All of the things that we can see, those are all on the outer layer of the onion. So then the question becomes, how do we get to the next layer?
So as we peel away the layers, I'd like you to be thinking about remembering that when we dig into culture, local cultures, larger organizational cultures, we're talking about perspectives, right? So we're talking about respecting a lot of different perspectives and kind of learning that. And it brings to mind a story. Baby mosquito is old enough to fly away now. Mommy mosquito says, be careful now, I taught you a lot of good stuff. It's a tough world out there. Baby mosquito goes off and flies. Comes back home later on. Mommy mosquito says, so how was it? I was a little bit worried about you. I know I taught you pretty well. Baby mosquito says, it's a fabulous world out there. Everywhere I went, people were clapping for me. Right? So it's a matter of perspective how we look at a lot of things. So how do we come together on that? We start to peel away these onion layers. So we talked about the artifacts, right? Those are the things that you can see, the first things that you can see. The next thing are the values, how we do it. What that means is how we want to do it. So Edgar Schein has a term for that called espoused values. That means what's written on your vision and mission statement. So your mission statement, your values statement, is how you want to be with each other, how you want to be with the customer. Okay. Think of another example, Enron. They had a 64-page manual on their mission and values. And so you have to ask yourself, based on the inner part of the onion that we go to next, you have to ask yourself, if they had those espoused values, how come that didn't translate into behaviors? Right? Did they even read it? Or did some people read it and say, that's beautiful, but you guys do that. That's not for me. So we go to the innermost part of the layer, and that is, after we look at the what's going on outside and what we want to be as we do these things for the community, and that is the assumptions. That's the internal assumptions about how we treat each other and how we interface with the customer. So if you have an assumption that you're a servant to help people and that you're not there for people to come to you, but the people are coming to you for help. If you have a local department, be careful of that supervisor, because that one's like, I don't know, nobody likes to work for that supervisor. You really have to do this and this and this to get around that. See, those are internal assumptions. And you might hear about that in a new place. You might be taken under somebody's wing as the new person, and kind of shown around. They're also kind of showing you the culture, too, as they tell you how to navigate through their culture, through their hierarchy, through the people that are like, well, if you want to learn about this, talk to that person. That person knows everything. Well, now you've got a subject matter expert. And so that becomes, that kind of filters in as a person's set of assumptions. They'll go into that job thinking, that's the subject matter expert, I gotta be careful of that one. They didn't experience that for themselves, did they? That became a set of assumptions. And one thing I've learned as a manager, if you treat people like they're honest and trustworthy, guess how they're gonna be. If you treat people like they're low-end workers, off the street, they're not educated, they're gonna try to steal from you, they're gonna be lazy on the job. If you treat them like that, what do you think they're gonna be like? So it's a very strong responsibility of the leadership to create, understand, and monitor that culture. Does that sound a little bit like continuous improvement? A little bit like PDSA? So, next slide.
Okay, so I think Michelle gave me this map of the DHS districts, and the reason why I'm putting this up here is because, well, at least my experience, and I think Ernest, your current setup is like this too, where we work for a large company that is dispersed across a large area, and everywhere is a little bit different. And it's not one size fits all, and that sounds like a really nice thing to say, but then at the same time, we come together and say, well, this seven-step problem-solving process is supposed to fit every situation. And it does, I think, as a framework, but a lot of times the culture that's happening in each of these different areas is very, very different. So we have to be able to work with that. And I think this onion model is like intellectually we can understand, yeah, there's something outside of, or you know, underneath the surface of the water. Yes, there's something outside of the onion, but what in the world am I supposed to do? Like, how do I do something about this? And as I was, in my experience, I had a territory that was like Western Canada, Washington, Oregon, Montana, and Idaho. And I'm thinking, how am I going to effectively talk about culture and somehow get people to be enthused about changing the culture in all of these different locations simultaneously? And to be honest, the first time that I got up in front of a group of truckers talking about culture was pretty awful. In fact, my very first week on the job, we were headquartered in Ann Arbor, and I went out there, and you know, I don't know anybody there except this new manager that I'm working for, and they had all of the 200 and some service center managers in one giant ballroom conference room, and I'm being introduced, and it is a sea full of light blue shirts and khakis. And here I am in some kind of bright green business casual dress, like, okay, I'm a little bit different here. So, oops, wrong way again. After several poor attempts at teaching modules on culture, I came across this video. Do I need to press the button?
Nope.
Okay. Sure. I came across this video. It landed pretty well with the truckers, so I think if they liked it, it's worth showing again here. It's from a TED Talk by, it was a video created by Derek Sivers, which was eventually adapted into a TED Talk, so we'll take a look at this.
If you've learned a lot about leadership and making a movement, then let's watch a movement happen start to finish in under 3 minutes and dissect some lessons. First, of course, a leader needs the guts to stand alone and look ridiculous. But what he's doing is so simple, it's almost instructional. This is key. You must be easy to follow. Now here comes the first follower with a crucial role. He publicly shows everyone else how to follow. Notice how the leader embraces him as an equal. So it's not about the leader anymore. It's about them, plural. Notice how he's calling you his friends to join in. So it takes guts to be your first follower. You stand out and you crave ridicule yourself. Being a first follower is an underappreciated form of leadership. The first first follower transforms a lone nut into a leader. If the leader is the flint, the first follower is the spark that really makes the fire. Now here's the second follower. This is a turning point. It's proof the first has done well. Now it's not a lone nut and it's not two nuts. Three is a crowd and a crowd is news. A movement must be public. Make sure outsiders see more than just the leader. Everyone needs to see the followers because new followers emulate followers, not the leader. Now here come two more people, then three more immediately. Now we've got momentum. This is the tipping point and now we have a movement. As more people jump in, it's no longer risky. If they were on the fence before, there's no reason not to join in now. They won't stand out, they won't be ridiculed, and they will be part of the in crowd if they hurry. And over the next minute, you'll see the rest who prefer to stay part of the crowd, because eventually they'd be ridiculed for not joining. And ladies and gentlemen, that is how a movement is made. So let's recap what we've learned. If you are a version of the shirtless dancing guy, all alone, remember the importance of nurturing your first few followers as equals, making everything clearly about the movement, not you. Be public, be easy to follow. But the biggest lesson here, did you catch it? Leadership is over-glorified. Yes, it started with the shirtless guy, and he'll get all the credit, but you saw what really happened. It was the first follower transformed a lone nut into a leader. There's no movement without the first follower. See, we're told that we all need to be leaders, but that would be really ineffective. The best way to make a movement, if you really care, is to courageously follow and show others how to follow. When you find a lone nut doing something great, have the guts to be the first person to stand up and join in.
You know, in a way, you guys are all lone nuts, right? And at the trucking company, the dancing guy pretty much became like our kind of call to arms. Okay, well, you know, this guy in Medford, you're going to be the dancing guy here. And, you know, I would have check-ins with him, but he was really the one that was kind of doing the call to action in Medford to get some continuous improvement to happen. And we weren't always using seven-step problem solving. I mean, sometimes it was just as basic as, let's clean out the storage shed because I can never find that wrench when I need it. I can never find these bolt cutters when I need them, or the right hazmat stickers when I need to put them on a load that has hazmat on it. And I think for me, what I found over many years of doing this lean work is that in the end, the real change comes from the way that we're interacting with people and not necessarily the tool itself. And I think early on, I was very focused on becoming very, very good at using all of the tools. But in the end, as good as we got at seven-step problem solving or process mapping, or no matter how complex the process was, when it really came down to it, it was about how we were interacting with people that do the process every day. And the seven-step problem solving process, or whatever lean tools you have, for someone that hasn't gone through that kind of training that you guys have, is a little bit of a foreign thing. So this video, I think, really captures that first follower thing and nurturing your first followers, so that when we go back into our offices and start to work on some problems, it's really about getting people to work on the problem, not the tool that we're using to solve the problem. So the way that this panned out at the trucking company was, we had been working on this initiative to implement Lean over the Pacific Northwest. And the way that we were kind of prescribed to do this from the corporate office was with a lot of training. And so we would go into each location and train on 5S, standard work, visual management, problem solving, and then they would have a project and some areas in the terminal or service center that they would have to clean up and add some visual management. And really things weren't going that well. It was, you know, people were coming to training and we would check the box and say, okay, so many people have been trained, and then we sent them back and then nothing is happening. So I had a conversation with my director, who was the director of the region, so I didn't report directly to him. And we kind of sat down and said, hey, this thing really isn't working. What are we really trying to do here? And eventually in this conversation, it came down to, well, I just want corporate off my back so that I can run my business the way that I know it should be run. And he's been working in trucking for a long time, and who am I to question how the trucking business should operate? Okay, well, tell me some more about that. And what we ended up doing was looking at our scorecard metrics. So there's an artifact, right? Part of the assumption is that he doesn't want to be pestered, really, by corporate. The way that we're not going to get pestered by them is making sure that we're meeting all of our goals and objectives. So let's start to look at those artifacts and find which locations are not really meeting those objectives. And then when we started to dig into it a little bit more, we're starting to talk about, well, it seems like whenever we have a problem in Portland, because we're talking about a transportation network that's kind of like a relay system. So if one thing becomes not on time, the whole thing starts to go a little wonky. We've got schedules not being met, and then we have to reschedule people that are going to drive at different times. So now we know we need to focus on that Portland service center nighttime operation and make sure that we're figuring out how they can be running on time more consistently. And then we ended up working with the supervisor in that area, and they developed a scheduling board. So visual management, and also that whole relay network, what we're really talking about was the value chain of our entire region. And so that was all through a conversation about what are we really trying to do here? How are we really doing? Because we would say, well, we're 80% on time, but that's because of XYZ excuses. And the reality was we really weren't doing that great about it. What can we do about it? And who can really do something about it? It certainly wasn't the director or me. It was the people that were running that overnight operation that could actually do something about getting it to stay on time. So over the years, I've learned other tools that didn't necessarily come from the Lean toolkit, maybe more from change management. So one of those is a stakeholder analysis. Ernest is going to show something called a key role map and also an accountability matrix. So back to the story about the trucking company. I've identified a few stakeholders here, and you can Google stakeholder analysis and find many, many different models of this kind of analysis. But what we're looking for is really, who are the people that can really do something about this? So one observation I made was the director, no matter what he was saying, like, he would go into a facility and say something and everyone would agree with him. And then as soon as he left the building, they would just go back to doing whatever it was that they were doing before, like it didn't even happen. And because we were such a large area, you know, he just didn't make it around to all of those places enough. So the observation was, hey, Mark, they're gonna do whatever you say. So if we team up on how we wanna improve this operation and where we wanna focus our efforts, they're going to listen to what you have to say because they want to be having the feeling that they're doing the right thing to make this region better. So that was what we, what I needed from them, this shared vision. And one thing I should mention, as I look at the stakeholder analysis from the perspective of my problem was, the problem I was trying to work was, how do I create a lean transformation in this big area? So what I need is this director to have a shared vision that we can make an improvement in this area, and that he trusts that I'm going to go to that location behind what he says and follow up with some more tools and lean thinking to help support improvement of a process. And what we ended up doing was, you know, Friday mornings became our weekly check-in. We were checking in on what was happening with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, gossiping about what was happening, but also talking about what kind of work, like what was happening in each of those locations. He was just in Pasco. I went right behind him. This is what he saw. This is what I saw. Then the next set of stakeholders I have on here are the drivers. So it was the drivers that are actually running that nighttime operation. And so they're certainly very highly influential and impacted because they're the actual people doing that work. What I need from them is some creativity. I'm not the one driving the truck, and I'm not the one loading the freight in, out of and into the different trucks. So I'm going to have to figure out how to get them to creatively offer these solutions. And I'm also going to have to trust that whatever we come up with, they're going to be willing to be that dancing guy, to try out something new and awkward, and that they're going to be working to get other people on board. And then I have the third one I have listed here as an example. These were like the corporate process owners. So the people that officially owned the process, they're really not impacted by what we did at the nighttime operation in Portland, Oregon, from their seat in Dallas, Texas. So we only involved them when we were changing global processes, but really most of the process changes that we were making were at a really local level, and we had complete authority to change them ourselves. We just had to get out there and do it. Another way of looking at this is through a type of affinity diagram. So what we have here is impact on this side and influence down here. If you had a lot of stakeholders, this is probably more useful, but you can see that I really needed to work with these people and not so much these people. So that was it on the stakeholder analysis. Do you want this? Okay.
Another way of looking at this, remember that the stakeholder analysis and the key role mapping are there to uncover certain parts of, important parts of the culture. And so where the stakeholder analysis is looking at pretty much everybody and finding out who informal leaders are, who has a lot of influence, who's impacted a lot, that helps you in your projects to hold those conversations with those people, to get alignment, to find out what the vision is. The key role map now looks at it a little bit different way, and it looks at the key decision makers for your project. So in any organization, you've got that hierarchy, and the key role map is a step-by-step to having a diagram that will, that you can refer to, that will show you who's your unbroken line to the executive sponsor, if you have a sponsor as high as the executive sponsor. It'll identify areas of gaps where as you go up in the hierarchy, you get decisions right over a, just over a department. I don't know if you have supervisors then managers, or managers then supervisors. So supervisors then managers. So supervisors will be responsible for making boots on the ground decisions with the team. That'll be changes in their process, tri-storming, right, doing the PPSA work, implementing new things. Above that person, you start to get to the manager level, where you can start to escalate things, to remove barriers, and to make maybe purchase decisions. as you go higher up to director level, if the project is or becomes interdepartmental, then you're going to want someone to be able to remove those barriers. And it may not be just to remove the barriers, but to provide support in connecting you with those people. As you go up higher through the organization, the time of these people becomes more and more valuable in certain respects. They're simply spread out in more different ways. So like stakeholder analysis, you start to see who you need to hold the conversations with earlier or later on. And as and if problems come up in the project, where do you need to go to get that help from? So it's a step-by-step. There's a couple of definitions. And this is, again, like the stakeholder analysis. I invite you, if you decide to use something like this, do like you do with Lean and the seven steps. Somebody was explaining it earlier, which is exactly what we like to do in Lean, is you go in and you figure out what's going on, and then you apply the steps that you need, not the steps that you don't need. So these definitions are just words. The ideas behind that is what's more important. Finding out these key decision-making roles and making sure that it's an unbroken line. So primary decision sponsor is your top-level sponsor. Could be an executive, could be a director level. Again, it depends on the scope of the project, if it's interdepartmental or a much larger project. You will have one of these. Preferably, you won't have more than one of those. As you can imagine, the conflicts that can start happening if you've got two primary decision makers with their own way that they interpret the vision and mission of the organization. So you want to have that kind of focus, one person to go to for that. Secondary decision sponsor. The secondary decision sponsor and the can be combined with these sometimes. Again, it depends on the level of the project. Secondary decision sponsor is that person that can make purchasing decisions, that can make policy decisions or advocate for those policy decisions, that, for example, a supervisor or manager can't go to the finance department and say, we need you to have a new policy for this. They'd be like, no, that's regulatory. So we need to go up the line to have the right conversations with the right people. Because if you're asking for a policy change, it might not quite be the right thing to do. It might be the right thing to do. But you'll have the dialogue to find that out. And again, this boils down to this cultural dialogue of inquiry, of finding out what your culture is like. How do we fit this to you? In my many years of teaching martial arts, we used to have a saying, we make the art fit you, we don't make you fit the art. And that's what leadership is about, and that's what culture is about. You shouldn't be a slave to the tools or the culture or whatever. It's the people, it's the interactions. We know what's the base of those interactions. Why do we have those interactions? Customers, the people that we serve. So project owner, process owner, you should be pretty familiar with those terms. They can be the same person sometimes. Project owner, that's the person responsible for reporting upwards about the outcomes of the project, reporting status, things like that to a hierarchy that's interested. And the process owner, of course, is that supervisor that runs that process. Does that make sense? So, and again, those terminology is fluid, just the idea. You see how the idea comes together in a minute. So step one, find the person up above staff. That's the first level in the process. And again, you'll probably have already identified that person. That person will be involved in the charter and things like that. So that person is process owner, possibly project owner. Next step, who do they report directly to? And this is the important step, and this will be illustrated in my example in a second. It's important not to have gaps. Because when you have to jump a gap, or if you feel like you've got the right line, but you missed it because you've got a gap in the line somewhere else, that's when you start to run into some issues. Okay? That's when you start to go to an executive sponsor, and she says, how come you didn't go to this person? Oh, because our mapping shows that we agreed to at the beginning, or we've always done it this way. No, I'm not supposed to say that. And so you want to eliminate that discussion happening later on. You want to have those discussions about stakeholder analysis, and hero mapping at the beginning of the project. So you don't get partway through the project to find out that somebody who's actually the owner doesn't want you to do it. Okay? And then, right, identify gaps, and then, in the same ways that she illustrated, how do you use that to hold the discussions? Do they understand the mission and vision? Do you feel this project fits with this mission and vision? Do you feel this is a good project? Can you support this? Okay, great. Now, what do we need from you? Have you heard of sponsor contracting? So that's something that you can do. You can go in with the sponsor and say, that being the case, here's your roles and responsibilities. For a successful project that gets sustained, they have roles and responsibilities also. The supervisor, again, is on boots on the ground, doing PDSAs all the time. Well, we thought this would work out real well, and it didn't. Okay, let's change that. Let's see if we can make that a little bit better. But at a level of policy and purchasing decisions, you want to make sure those people, okay, you show up to the Kaizen once, and you round once a quarter, because people will see that it's important. And what will people do if you hold something up that's important? So if you talk about in your yearly review, if your boss says, so how many lean projects did you get done? Oh, I got 5. Oh, great. That's great. And you got good outcomes on them, right? Yeah, we have good outcomes on all of them. But if you go into your yearly review and your boss says, how many days did you show up to work this year? And if they do that for a couple of years, what's going to be important to you? How many days you show up? And if your boss doesn't round with you on your projects, you're going to see that projects aren't important. And you may continue to do it, it may fall off your radar. And so that's part of project success, project sustain. Is it continually communicated? Is it modeled by the leadership? And is it reinforced by leadership that it's important? Then it'll be on people's radar. So my colleague went into the emergency department and had a project, pretty large project in the emergency department. So you can see that the hospital COO was the primary decision maker. That's pretty high up, because they had lots of departments involved. And so they figured that would be the best place. So in the beginning, they talked to the hospital COO and decided that the ED physician director, because the physicians were going to be the primary team members, and a lot of this was focused around the physicians, that would be the best reporting model. But as he completed the project and tested it and decided it was great and developed an implementation plan, then the ED physician director with dotted reporting to those manager level people found a lot of pushback. So my colleague came back a few weeks later to find no project, no changes made. So he talked to the ED physician, he said, man, I got a lot of pushback from them, and they're talking about filling in, and we don't have the personnel for it, and we can't do that, and you know, you told me about the testing, but we're not really sure that the testing was adequate. And so, went to the hospital COO. And as they looked at the project and the people, they figured there was a hole here, there's a gap here, that because it was so interdepartmental, that what they really needed was the project owner and the secondary decision sponsor to be here. And this as another secondary decision sponsor. So that with this person involved, you had these departments involved. And as this person was informed, and these people involved in the solutions, what they developed was then implemented. My colleague comes back a few weeks later, a month later, and there's a wonderful project running beautifully in the emergency department. Because they had a gap, and in the beginning, they thought what was logical to them, instead of starting here and going upwards, he started here. His takeaway, I'm going to do a key role map for every project. And so the project could have gotten derailed, but they had the right executive sponsor. So So they work through it, they navigated through it. But that's why you start here. Start where? Where what? Start where the interaction is. That's where the action is. And to support that, to support this, the people doing the work, the interactions with customers, this is one way, hero mapping, of finding out how to support that. Over here, this is a change disruption impact rank. I'm not going to do too much with that because you can read a lot about that. We know that people don't resist a change because they think a project is good or bad. They resist a change because of the level of disruption in their job. And so there's a way to then look at these people and find out with the level of disruption, what are you asking them to do? One of my favorite things is, right, up here, when this person makes a decision, it's a big gear. Your gear goes like this. The person says, nah, I made a little decision today. I'm good. That's good. You go down to this level, and there's smaller gears. And when the big gear does this, they do this. Oh, I made a change today. Wow, it's going to take me a week to get through this. When you get down here, the big wheel goes change, change, change. And these guys go change, change, change. People at the staff level are going change, 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 right? So this is a way to uncover those kinds of disruptions. So in your 7-step process, you want to be doing the key role mapping and the stakeholder analysis up there. Step one. That should be part of these dialogues and stuff about the project before you really get into it. Start investing time in person power. The next thing I'm going to talk about is the accountability matrix, and that happens right up here, about step 6. Before the project is finished, you guys make an implementation plan and sustain plan, right? So the accountability matrix is part of that. How do we define accountability? When we agree to do something and then do it. Whether that's on time or in a certain technology. Someday, technology is going to work, and we'll all be surprised. So, accountability sometimes is when we agree to do something and we didn't do it. So how do we look at that through the eyes of culture? How do we take this cultural information, right, the artifacts, the stuff we put out there, the measurements, the graphs, the huddle board, what are our values and our vision and mission? And are we aligned with that on this project? Are we aligned with that for this group, for this community? Are we aligned with that? And then the assumptions. So we get down to the basic assumptions, how we're gonna make this happen, because we know these things happen. Step one, set expectations and invite them. So as you hold these dialogues with people, and in the key role mapping, remember we're going upwards and saying this is what we're going to ask you to do. This is going back to the interactions and saying, what do you need? So you set expectations based on your values and your mission and your vision, and you invite the commitment. Okay, we'll agree to do this. We'll agree to be held accountable. There's your status column. Some of your action plans. You ask what has been agreed and communicated, because it don't work if everybody doesn't know about it. So you want to involve as many people as possible. And that's that basic assumptions part. That's the what we do. Measure progress. Okay? This is going to be in a loop with the next one. So you measure progress. Why do we measure progress? Two reasons. Anybody know the two reasons we measure progress? What was that? See growth, yeah. What kind of growth? Good growth? Yeah. Is your project doing what you thought it was doing? Is it doing what we expected of it, or is it doing something else? And what's the other thing? We measure progress to get feedback. Because we even might be doing well and getting great numbers, and half the department hates what they're doing, what the change is. So you have to work with that. So what methods of ongoing check-in will be employed, and what are the questions that we ask? It's the same thing in Lean when you say, we want this new thing to be happening, how do we measure it? So we measure it, we put it on the model. Again, these are artifacts. So here's this feedback loop. You create the feedback loop when you start the dialogue in the beginning and get the measurement of progress and the feedback loop. Remember, every project has three objectives. The business objectives, the technical objectives, and the human objectives. So we measure the business and technical objectives, right? Or are we measuring the human objectives? And that means we have to understand the culture. Because if you want to know what their objectives are, then you have to understand what has meaning to those people. And linked to consequences. Here's where it takes a little more effort to go to the culture, to go to the people, and hold a dialogue about what has meaning. When I worked at Intel, the failure analysis group, there was a executive level person that had some inscribed pencils in his pocket. Once a month, he would go around and give one of those pencils to one or two people that had done an outstanding job in the department. In that culture, in that department, those people would like wear it, like, oh, my jacket slipped a little bit, and everybody would see they got the pencil in it. Or they'd have it on their desk, okay? Because that executive understood what had importance for those people and he helped create that. That pencil, go to the aerospace plant I worked at, that pencil, be like, drop, oh, sorry, has no meaning to them. So is it a pizza party? Is it flex time? Is it coffee coupons or something like that? Department doesn't drink coffee and they all drink herbal tea. Coupons, maybe not so good. So you have to listen to their culture. You have to see the artifacts. When you see the artifacts, the behaviors, the things they put up, they're emulating what's important to them. And then you can have that dialogue on linking to the rewards, right? To their values, linking the rewards to the successes of the project. So to begin wrap up,
So there were three models in there that we looked at that I think are all kind of getting at the same thing, or three tools really. It was the accountability matrix, the key role map, and the stakeholder analysis. And you know, they're all, I think the objective is to understand the right people that you need to be working with in order to make a change happen. And then that last one, the accountability matrix, is giving some more framework to kind of plan your conversation with them. And even the stakeholder analysis does that to a degree as well. You can do these formally, like the key role map, I think, is really useful if you have a big project that is touching multiple departments. But the stakeholder analysis, you know, it's just something I could jot down on a piece of paper by myself and think, okay, who in the Pasco Service Center is going to be my dancing guy? And what do I need from him? And what does he need from me so that he is following creating a lean culture and continuous improvement in their service center? If you go to the next slide. So the real question is kind of to bring this home to, why are we even changing, or why are we continuously improving? This all comes back to the vision and mission and values of the organization. And the artifacts themselves can sometimes get distracting. I know in some places that I've worked before, you know, we get our A3s and our seven-step problem solving templates out, and over time I've seen it happen multiple times where it becomes a competition for writing the best A3, and that's not really what we're here for. We're here to serve our customers, and so, you know, if we have to make a tweak to the template or modify a process a little bit to continuously improve, I think that's how you change culture, because I think that's why how we all came to be in this place to begin with.
And so, to wrap up, remember that this is about holding the dialogues with people in the same way that we involve people in the project. To get buy-in, to get better solutions, to get better brainstorming in Lean, this is the culture aspect. This is the human objectives of the project. This will help your project go better, it'll help sustain it to have this structure. And it's not about checking the checkboxes. It's about going to the action, the interactions. So I'd like to illustrate with another little story. In aerospace, when I was a beginning manager, I was given a small project to do. There was a coatings department that put special coatings on the turbine blades, and their glove usage was too high. They were supposed to be using about 100-150 pairs of gloves a month, and they were using 700 or 800 pairs a month. So I was tasked with going down and investigating and finding out how we can improve the process or the training or whatever, right? It's Lean, right? Here's a symptom of a problem. We don't know what the problem is yet. We don't know root cause, and we don't know a solution yet. So I went and talked with a couple of supervisors and asked them to give some more training and kind of monitor them and ask them if, when they're trying to change gloves, you really need to change those gloves. You know, kind of gentle reminders. So I came back a month later and checked the numbers, and the glove usage was about 700 or 800 a month. Now that company has espoused values like everybody else. Respect, integrity, safety, things like that. So I got with the supervisors again, one of which thankfully had enough respect for me to help me out. I said, what's going on? Do we need to download people? Do we need to train them more? What's happening? And my friend said, slow down, Ernest. Take a little stop. Why don't you just come up with us to the area where we're doing the coatings and hang out with us for a while. Talk to us, see what's going on. Maybe you can find out what's going on. And so I took advantage of that opportunity and went down to the area of the room where they were doing that. And what did I find out? There was a couple people that were influencers. There was a supervisor who was super busy. That may have been revealed in the key role math, it may have been revealed in the stakeholder analysis. Again, it's the idea, not the tool. I just hung out with them for a while. What was happening was, as they were using these chemicals and pastes and putting these coatings on, the gloves were melting. And exposing their hands to those chemicals. Not too good at all. So a couple people would constantly go around, and the people would say, no, I can use this glove a little bit more. I don't want to use too many gloves. And they'd say, no, he's getting that stuff on their hands. You can't do that. So they would help the people to stay safe. Their basic assumptions, how they treated each other, were in alignment with the company values. And it was in alignment with the idea of respect for people. So I learned some good lessons out there. I went to the management, we investigated other gloves, and why did they have the wrong gloves? Because it's the gloves that we always wanted. Change the materials and the chemicals, and we looked at the gloves. So, in respect for that, we got different gloves. I come back a month later, and the glove usage was 100 to 150 a month. Yes, such a bright bunch of people. I love Lean. Well, I wasn't too bright, but we all right. We all start somewhere, right? So my friend helped me out and taught me that lesson, go to where that. And we learn that in Lean, but do we learn to observe culture also? We learn to observe artifacts and help people through the change. It's the difference between implementation and installation. Come in, you got new stuff, epic. The wonderful technology that's going to save healthcare, medical records. And they installed it. They came in, they gave people the training, they turn the key, and nobody could use it. because they forgot about going from knowledge to ability. And that's what this cultural thing is. You've got lean projects. Let's also look at the human aspects, the cultural aspects of this, and work this in. So, Maria and I would like to ask you to go back to your offices, your departments, and look at the artifacts. Listen, if you're the invisible person, and you come in there and stand in the middle there, what would you see? What would you hear? What would you observe? And think about how that matches up with your department, with the organization. What artifacts are valued as important? Because not everything is important. Some can be more important than others. And what does that tell you about that group? What does that tell you about how that group practices how they want to be? And why do you think those things are? And we'd like to open it up now to questions. Any questions?
I have a question for you. When you started with provenance, what were some of those artifacts that were the biggest challenge to overcome in that environment?
Let's see, how much time do you have? I knew healthcare was going to be very different from aerospace and manufacturing and that. And I knew I was going to be on a steep learning curve. 6 years later, I'm still on a steep learning curve. But, you go to a nursing department is a perfect example, because that's like the core of the caregivers, their assumptions. That's the core area of how they treat each other and how they treat patients. Okay? And they've got that servant caregiver type of attitude, where we have to convince them to care for the caregivers also. And so the artifacts that you see on the wall are some hospital metrics. You'll see one of the major things you'll see is which nurses are assigned to which patients, because it's so important to get that handoff. And that handoff is also a cultural artifact. How have they developed that? And so one of the most difficult things I've had to overcome is in healthcare, they've developed a very powerful culture of giving care to the people at the expense of themselves, that's the level. And healthcare has some other issues that are wrapped up in that. A lot of healthcare has grown up with a blame and shame culture because they feel that how they treat the patient is critical. And a lot of times it is. But we know in lean and continuous improvement that you don't get PDSA, you don't get continuous improvement if you don't make mistakes. And so they have a very mistake-averse culture. So that's probably the biggest challenge that I've come up to, is when you come in and you see these artifacts, the things that they're tracking, the things that they're measuring are all patient-centered. You come in and say, let's do a project, let's improve this. You know the dog that hears, oh, good boy, Rover, good boy. No, bad boy, don't do that. Don't do that, Rover. What does the dog hear? Blah, 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 Rover, blah, 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 Rover. So what they hear is, blah, 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 I'm not doing my job well enough. We have to improve it. That's where this cultural stuff comes in. Because you have to have stakeholder analysis there is even more important than people. Because they have those subject matter experts. They have those people that are the informal leaders. They're the people that have been there 45 years instead of 30 years. How long have you been here? Right? Icebreakers. How long have you been here? 48 years. How long have you been here? 28 years. 30 years. They've got a good culture. But we have to be careful and learn about that culture and peel that onion so that I don't walk in there and say, let's do some improvements. Really? You think I'm not doing my job well? That's been the biggest. Any other questions? Yes.
Good question. Kind of in terms of the shirtless dancing guy, do you, when you talk about going through and identifying, you know, who's going to be that person for that area, do you already have in mind, or do you have a conversation with them about kind of the second people, those early adopters, you know, like, what's your message to them, trying to get those to kind of get on and kind of send the message to everyone else to join on?
So I think, going way back in my career, I started out in supply chain management, and the lean principle that aligns with that the most is pull versus push. So whenever I'm talking about things like culture or just like trying to get people to continuous improvement, I'm trying to situate it in a way where they're asking me for information as opposed to me pushing the information to them. I think over the years I've found it's best for me to just get out of my own way. And instead of trying to orchestrate this whole thing happening, just show little pieces of it. And then find the person that's like, hey, I'm interested in that. Show them a little bit more. They're probably gonna go show it to the people that they work most closely with, and then they kind of form a team and come asking for more information. An informal team.
Any other questions? Anything else?
Well, we're sticking around through at least lunchtime, so
yes.
If you think of anything else, please feel free to come and ask. Thanks.
Thank you.